Antonio Rafael's love for wild spaces and wild creatures started pretty young.
So I've always had like a fascination and love of nature and animals and digging in through the garden and collecting roly-polies and looking for frogs when I went downriver to visit family.
Now, years later, Antonio's part of a movement to help other black and brown kids and adults find their own connections with the natural world, especially when those connections need a little more love and attention. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's loads of research that shows spending time in nature is like a 1-2 punch for improving your mental and physical health. This past year, being outside was a way for a lot of us to feel grounded in a moment of deep uncertainty, whether that was as simple as a walk in the park or exploring all the beautiful landscapes of the Mitten State. We like to hold up America's wild spaces as equal playgrounds for all. But if we're honest, access to nature is not as universal as that. Fewer than 1/4 of visitors to our national park system are people of color. And many black and brown people have been told in ways both subtle and very explicit that they don't belong. But there are groups that are actively working to change that narrative. They were featured in a series of stories on the website Planet Detroit, written by Rhonda Smith. And she joins me today. Hi, Rhonda.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've also invited Antonio Rafael, an activist and environmentalist from Detroit. He's also director of DLEAP, the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program. It's an initiative of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. Hi, Antonio.
Greetings.
So I wanted to start by asking you both just to tell us about one of your favorite wild places, maybe a park or trail that you love. I'm not asking you to give up your best-kept secret, but if there's something you could share with us, a place that you love to be.
Yeah, I'm sure Antonio will have much wilder places than I would. I'm not a great adventurer that way, but Belle Isle has a lot of hidden nooks and crannies that I like.
Antonio, how about you?
There's so many good places in this country. It's crazy. I just came back from Big Bend in South Texas and the Rio Grande border, and I spent a week there, and it was just incredibly beautiful. And the desert's a new environment for me, so it's kind of just like high up there for me right now. But I really love Lake Superior.
Yes, wild though it is. Rhonda, can you tell me a little bit about why you felt this was an important subject that you wanted to explore?
Oh, yes, definitely. In addition to being a writer, I'm a naturopathic doctor. And when people come to me, I look at the foundations of health first, and nature being one of them. And so I recognize the healing power of nature and the fact that we as African Americans and other people of color have experienced a lot of trauma here in the country, and going to traditional medical doctors doesn't always provide a fix for that, and nature does. And so the work that Antonio is doing in his various spheres, I thought needed to be highlighted, because people need to know that there are places that they can go, safe places that they can go to experience nature and get healing. And the cost would be just for gear. You know, they have gear libraries, a lot of the organizations that Antonio works with, and even some of them provide transportation. So knowing that those barriers will not be there, and you can still experience nature and receive as somewhat passive healing, because you don't have to do much but just be outdoors and experience the energy from the sun and the soil and the air. Definitely were reasons I wanted to be able to highlight these stories.
Rhonda, may I ask you, what are some of the central things that we know to be true about racial disparities when it comes to access to nature?
Well, some of the things that we know to be true are the differences in money, so the cost, also the access in terms of how far out. If you think of metro parks in Detroit, they're all outside of the city of Detroit. So those are things that we know that are different. And then in terms of knowledge base, that they are accessible to people of color and welcoming. I think those are some of the differences.
Yeah, we should talk more about the ways in which spaces are welcoming or not. But Antonio, I had a question for you on the question of cost. I feel like there's a cost of, you know, transportation, just getting where you're going. But there's also this entire industry built around the outdoors that seems very much geared toward white consumers. Is that something you've observed as well?
Working with a lot of young folks, you're not going to come across a lot of them in Detroit who have muck boots to go into, you know, murky waters. People don't keep a lot of extreme, like, winter warmth gear, generally speaking. Having tents that can handle like rain, a little bit of rain. Those are all definitely things that are barriers to entry for camping, hiking, the outdoors. A lot of folks don't have canoes and kayaks. It's about like a relationship to the land. And a lot of folks in Detroit live on very small lots. So you don't just tend to keep the sort of equipment that would make entering nature much easier.
Rhonda, you've written about the fear and trauma that being in the woods can bring up for Black people. Could you say more about that?
Yes. Several people that I know, and I'm sure Antonio has heard this too, when we see scary movies, we always say, oh, why does it have to be the white people who are falling? And you know, we operate differently when it comes to the woods because of the history of the hangings of people of color, particularly in this country, African Americans. And so those are the types of memories that we have, be it from our ancestors, be it from just cultural memory, you know, and even the things that we're seeing now, which are not necessarily being out in the woods. But even if you're on a road jogging and it's not in a familiar place. And so open spaces and the wild spaces, forests, aren't very welcoming for us because of the history of what they've meant to our people.
Antonio, as you mentioned, you do a lot of work with younger people. You've had a chance to work with a lot of kids through the Detroit Leadership Environmental Education Program. And I just wanted to ask, as you interact with kids who maybe have, a geographic disconnect from natural spaces and wildness, like what kinds of preconceptions might they have about getting out in backcountry when you start talking to them about it?
A big fear of like the water is like things like Jaws movies that kind of overrepresent the potential danger of these spaces in our mind and the media that we've consumed. Forests, people are afraid of like bears or one of the things that I always tell the young people is human beings are the scariest thing in nature. The United States we're on the tail end of a pretty ecocidal history. And the spaces in nature that we do have are often like fragments left over of something much, much greater. So it's always interesting to talk to them because our program really takes a deep look at environmental history and the history of the land and the way that colonization and spatial segregation and racism impact people. So we get young people to think critically about these issues.
What we've been talking about, these are not small issues in Native and Indigenous communities. Antonio, how do you talk to the young people you work with about a sense of mutual ownership and having some respect for the history of land and who's had access to land in the past?
Absolutely. A lot of the curriculum that we look at in the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program connects with the histories and stories of First Nations peoples. As we're discussing Michigan and how Michigan came to be, we have to talk about colonization. It's absolutely necessary. And I think a lot of times the conversation is left there. You know, people will do a land acknowledgement. People will talk about colonization. These are the names of the native people who are here, the Anishinaabe. But moving it beyond actually building genuine, real relationships with those people, I think is kind of the next level. And both in Black to the Land and with the Detroit Leadership and Environmental Education Program, we're trying to forge those relationships between the reservation and the hood. In our last year, we were allowed to do field trips pre-corona. And we took a field trip up to a Native American farm called Zibi Midgewing up in Petoskey after we went and visited one of the last bits of old growth forests left in Michigan in Hartwick Pines. So is this after studying the history of the clear cutting of forests by settlers and discussing white capital accumulation through so much land that was passed to settlers, we go to some of the very last bits of large old-growth forest in Michigan. And then we continued up north to spend time with a Native American community who was celebrating their fall corn harvest. So in that way, students are actually building relationships with Native people. And the Sugar Bush is another project that we do that builds relationships between Native peoples and urban peoples. When we did the Sugar Bush project, we brought in sugar makers from two or three different reservations to come spend time with us, to teach us, to pass on stories and knowledge, and to pass on skills.
We've got to take a quick break. When we get back, why access to nature is an important part of healing from racial trauma. That's on the way in just a minute.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Antonio, if I can ask, would you mind telling us a little bit about your entree into wild places? And, you know, the thing you said about humans being the scariest thing in nature, what your experience of that is?
I definitely trace it, you know, ancestrally. I think I come from a family of farmers, you know, one generation ago. My grandma on my Puerto Rican side, who I was close to growing up, her family had a farm in the hills of Puerto Rico. She was a jíbaro. And my grandfather worked in a sugarcane plantation in Puerto Rico as well. So my grandma always like recreated Puerto Rico in her yard with flowers in the summertime. My mom kept flowers. I would spend a lot of time outside growing up. Our family would go on an annual canoe/glamping. I call it glamping, glamorous camping trip. Another thing is my grandma would take us to the metro parks just to like hike and walk around because it did remind her of being back home in Puerto Rico. I also spent a lot of time playing sports growing up. My parents were heavily involved in like coaching us in athletics activities, and I was the kid who was like exploring the flowers and playing with ants and stuff like that while I was supposed to be paying attention to the baseball game. So I've always had like a fascination and love of nature and animals and digging in through the garden and collecting roly-polies and looking for frogs when I went downriver to visit family. So yeah, I've always just been driven towards it, but my family has certainly given us a number of avenues into nature, particularly with an annual camping trip.
I've talked to people of color whose families didn't really have a history of this stuff, but who were interested in exploring parklands and wild places, and maybe they were able to, you know, sort of figure out where they wanted to go and make their plans, and you know, overcome some of the cost issues, and then getting there, sometimes having interactions with white people on trails or in those public spaces that were decidedly unwelcome. And I wonder if if you talk to the kids about that and the possibility of finding themselves in that situation?
Certainly it's something that I think we all grow up knowing and experiencing, and the idea of alienation and marginalization is something that I think is very particular to extremely segregated communities like Metro Detroit. So I think a lot of students already have quite a bit of experience just growing up in Metro Detroit, particularly if you have any family in the suburbs, what it feels like to be targeted, alienated, marginalized, picked on by cops, these sorts of experiences. It's something we touch on a little bit, like we set norms and kind of rules and ideas as to best behaviors in going out together towards the beginning of the year, and we touch on them as need be throughout the year. But generally speaking, like I'm not entering nature with the young folks with a warning. You know, it's more like a, hey, today we're going to be looking for birds, or this is how we look for mushrooms, and this is the kind of things you're looking for. I don't think, like, generally speaking, at every outing, it makes the most sense to kind of pump them into the negative potential pitfalls. We're often driving them different places, so it's just about making sure everyone's licenses are and license plates are good. Making sure people have insurance who are the drivers in our groups. And those are significant barriers to entry. A lot of the suburbs around Detroit are like Ferguson in that they like depend upon poor black and brown folks driving through their communities without car insurance to help pay for their bills. You find a lot of, like, that to me is one of the leading causes of access to nature. There's such a significant amount of people who cannot afford car insurance in Detroit, or who have, some sort of like suspension or hold or problem with their license, or their tags are out of date.
Can you tell us about some of the experiences you have had with young people who are maybe getting their first taste of being outdoors, and things that you saw opening up for them?
Which thing to talk about? I don't even know. I guess we've been participating with Friends of the Rouge on a number of projects over the last couple years, one of which is really beautiful. We started the Sugar Bush Project with urban indigenous communities and Black to the Land and Detroit Outdoors and Friends of the Rouge. We were actually tapping maple trees in Rouge Park and creating maple syrup. And a lot of young folks tend to avoid outdoors in wintertime. In that end of winter period where the snow is melting and it's so mushy on the ground and the snow even looks black and dark from like the soil and things like that in the city, that's when we're out there in the sugar bush, learning how to identify maple trees, tapping trees. And for all of these students, it was absolutely their first time doing this, chopping wood. We learned how to start fires from flint and steel. All this in Rouge Park. And I know for sure this is absolutely the first time any of these young folks have done that. And it was empowering.
Rhonda, we know that there are poorer health outcomes for Black Michiganders than white Michiganders. It's a variety of factors, of course, but what connection do you make when you're talking to folks about how being outdoors can improve that equation?
Well, particularly I talk about the negative effects of the foods that we eat that are often available to us, not necessarily those that we want, but those are available, and how they have damaged neural pathways in our minds, but how nature can help heal that. The microbiome of the soil can do that. The strength of the sun helping to create vitamin D in your body that helps to keep your immunity strong. So those types of things, you may not be able to afford a doctor's visit or to be able to fulfill a prescription, but you can change your neural pathways by being out in beautiful nature and seeing things that just actually changes your mind, literally. So those are the types of approaches that I like to take in encouraging people to take advantage of nature.
Rhonda, Antonio, it's been great talking with you. I hope you get a lot more time outside this year.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Take care. Miigwech.
And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Today's episode was produced by April Van Buren. Our theme music is by 14KT with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.